Hi everyone, Bread and Goods is sponsored by Works in Progress, the online magazine. I really enjoy reading Works in Progress, and my favorite piece of theirs has been The Housing Theory of Everything. In the piece, the authors provide astounding evidence for why a huge swath of our social ills are caused by our inability to build more housing. It's a pretty mind-blowing piece if you've never read it. You can find their works online on worksinprogress.co. The link is in the show notes.
Welcome to this episode of the Bread and Goods podcast. I'm resuming after a break. Our guest today is Pramit Bhattacharya. He's a journalist at The Mint, and more importantly, he's written some extremely good articles about India's national accounts and statistical system. So hi, Pramit, nice to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here. Just a small correction. I am now an independent journalist, so I write for Mint and also for Hindustan Times, but not full-time, don't work full-time for them.
All right. Thank you for that. First thing I'd like to ask you is that, you know, for its level of development, India used to have an unusually large and detailed statistical system. And it was largely because at independence, we had a few key people who pushed that forward. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would like to start a little bit back from even before independence to sort of explain what happened around the time of independence. So India had a very unique kind of anti-colonial struggle in the sense that the economic question was always at the heart of the freedom struggle, right from the time of Dadabhai Nauroji. The question of whether Indians were earning enough, whether they were being taxed far more than what they could pay, the question of taxable capacity, the question of national income, it was at the forefront of nationalist consciousness and among the nationalist elites, because Congress itself was founded by the elites. And so this was a key question, and there were demands right from the late 19th century, during the Deccan famine, even after that, on the question of national income, to have detailed surveys of Indian industries, household industries, of informal sector. And the British government to some extent responded to these demands by setting up some committees to review the state of the economy, the state of the statistical system. But those recommendations did not actually fructify, because these committees were largely in the 1920s and 1930s. And after that, the British efforts were all directed towards the Second World War. So, but by this time, the Indian public discourse had begun talking about, had begun focusing on questions on economic issues. And so getting growth, getting high growth and eradicating poverty were always on the top of the agenda, right from, you know, day zero, not even from day one, right from day zero. And planning at that time was seen as a way where which would enable India to quickly raise her standards of living, to quickly raise investment rates, to quickly raise growth rates, and to quickly eradicate poverty. At that time, there was no distinction seen in terms of growing the pie and distributing or redistributing the pie, because the pie itself was so small that across the nationalist schools of thought, right from Subhash Chandra Bose on the left to Sardar Patel on the right, there was a broad consensus that you have to grow the pie to make any appreciable dent on poverty. And planning was not seen as a way where the state would come in and then, you know, eliminate the private sector and, you know, sort of take over the reins. It was seen just as a way to fill the gap, because the private sector itself was quite small, and the rate of growth that was needed to eradicate poverty quickly was something that they felt was would not be possible if business as usual continued. Of course, I mean, they were also shaped by the economic ideologies of that time, but it was a broad development consensus of that time. And in that process, in the work of the National Planning Committee, of which Nehru was the chairman, founded and set up by Subhash Chandra Bose in 1938, they discovered that to do any kind of realistic planning, British India did not have the right numbers, the right data. And so there was this quest to revamp the statistical system. And that's why one of the early appointments was of P.C. Mahalanobis, who by then had made a name for himself in the world of statistics in random sampling, as an honorary statistical advisor. And later he became a planning commission member as well. And he really sort of helped draw up a roadmap for revamping the statistical system, along with two other very distinguished economists. One was VKRV Rao, who in 1930s, around the same time as Simon Kuznets was extending Colin Clare's work in the US to produce national income estimates for the US, VKRV Rao around the same time was writing his dissertation thesis under Colin Clare's supervision in Cambridge, producing the national income estimates for India. So they were pioneers at the same level as Kuznets and Ragnar Frisk and Tinbergen and others. And the other person was D.R. Gadgil of the Gokhale Institute. And Gadgil was one of the pioneering surveyors. ISI surveys in the pre-independence period were largely centered on agriculture. Household surveys was something that Gokhale Institute in Pune actually had much more expertise and experience in. And in fact, the first NSS round was a joint initiative of Mahalanobis and Gadgil. And at that, after the first sort of, or even before the first round was complete, Gadgil withdrew. And the Gadgil-Mahalanobis debate on the role of NSS, role of survey, is something that has played out over the next few decades, and we can come to this later. But basically, you know, these individuals, along with other individuals such as Pitambar Pant, who's a remarkable guy, Nehru's private secretary, whom Nehru sends to ISI to take training in statistics, comes back and then gets into the planning commission, becomes the head of the prospective planning division, in charge of formulating long range plans. And develops he's one of the key guys who has a good sense of how to push the bureaucracy, what are the data requirements to be used for planning purposes, as well as connections with Western academia. So people like from Harvard and Stanford and other universities write letters to Pitambar Pant saying that, look, people like B.S. Minhas, for instance, is just going to finish his PhD. He has very good theoretical and empirical skills. He would be very useful to you. So can he come and join you? So there is a bevy of star economists who are not at that time star economists. They later become star economists, people like T.N. Srinivasan, Jagdish Bhagwati, who are A. Vaidyanathan, Ashok Rudra, who are all sort of under the tutelage of Pitambar Pant, and who all get into policy-oriented economics because of their association with the planning division of ISI and the prospective planning division, which at that time worked very closely together. So there was this network of institutions, CSO, ISI, ISI Kolkata unit, which was also doing NSS, then ISI Delhi unit, which was where the planning division was centered, and you had a prospective planning division headed by someone like Pant, who was also an ISI product. So, and then you had external sort of people coming, people like Ragnar Frisk. I think he spent around three to four months, sometime in 1955, mid-1950s, and produced, I think, more than 12 to 15 papers on planning within that short window. Later, of course, Muni Mukherjee also traveled, or earlier, before that, Muni Mukherjee had traveled to Norway to meet him. The idea was that you get the best of the planners from across the world at ISI. You get the best of the techniques in linear programming, input-output analysis, etc. which were needed for national income accounting and long-term planning, and you get them to also vet some of the work that the Indian statisticians, Indian economists were doing, and to point out their mistakes, review their work, and give them feedback, and then see how the globally accepted methods could be adapted to Indian soil, to Indian conditions. So there was an awareness that we needed to learn from the best, but there was also an awareness that all the methods that are so-called standard methods may not necessarily apply in all cases in the Indian context. With a country with a large informal sector, with a large pool of disguised unemployed, all the leading economists and statisticians were very much well aware of how much these standards, new standards of national accounting, new standards of statistics had to be tailored to sort of meet Indian requirements. So I'll stop there and take further questions from you.
You know, I had two thoughts when I heard you. The first is that that seems incredibly fragmented, right? You had three or four central agencies, then you had the ISI at Kolkata, and even today you have some of those plus state level, state level statistical agencies. And that's my first part, is that, you know, how did they deal with that fragmentation? Did it lead to any conflicts of turf or so on? And my second question is, how did they adapt those statistical methods to the Indian context, where, you know, surveys are not entirely reliable? You may not, and in fact, these days we haven't had a census for about 14 years now. And you know, that like how did that adaptation happen? Because a critic might say, hey, numbers are numbers, our sampling methods are sampling methods. Why would you want to change these reliable things?
Yeah, so to answer the first question, at that time, although there were different agencies, the people manning those agencies were connected through the link of ISI. Almost everyone had an ISI link. So Pitamber Pant, for instance, was the joint secretary of ISI. He was the private secretary to the PM, and he was the head of the Perspective Planning Division at the same time. Moni Mukherjee was the head of the National Income Unit at the Finance Ministry while being a worker on leave from ISI. So similar, so there was not that much of a problem of coordination at that time. And finally, of course, the big factor was Mohanlal Nobis's role as a statistical advisor. So he was like a one-man statistical commission. In fact, the Rangarajan Commission in 2001 uses that phrase, that what we want today in the 21st century is for a committee or a commission that will play collectively the role that Mohanlal Nobis single-handedly played at that time. So it is impossible to sort of recreate that early environment, right? If today Private Secretary to Prime Minister Modi is appointed as the head of Niti Aayog statistical unit or something, I mean, there will a lot of you know, it won't be accepted. At that time, the nationalist leadership could afford to do that because they had won their laurels from the freedom struggle. People like Mohanlal Nobis were close associates of people like Tagore. VKRV Rao himself was a participant in the freedom struggle, was associated with Nehru for even before independence. D.R. Gadgil also had a similar background, was associated with the nationalists for a long time. So they could operate in different environment, and it was a very closed sort of, in some sense also a very closed group. There were not many people who were doing statistics at that time. Remember, the idea of random sampling was sort of I mean, it got crystallized and sort of got started getting implemented in field trials in agriculture only in the 1920s. So to think of a large scale random sample covering the entire country, gathering different kinds of data in 1950 was something that was almost unthinkable. And it is to the credit of Mohanlal Nobis that he could think, not only think about it, but could also dare to execute it. And it was something that even someone like Edwards Deming, who was in the US Department of Commerce and US Census Office for a long time, he wrote in Mohanlal Nobis' obituary in the American Statistician when he passed away in 72, that when Mohanlal Nobis initially shared the details of what NSS was going to do, he was shocked, and he felt that this could not be achieved because even the US was struggling to sort of roll out its own surveys. In many ways, the US and NSS, the US Census Bureau surveys and NSS surveys followed a similar trajectory, the subjects they covered, the way they expanded, and so on. So at that stage, there was also a sense of a missionary zeal among these people that we are doing something new. We are all part of nation building. So even when there were differences of opinion, even when there were conflict, they found a way to sort of engage and argue. And if you look at especially the Gadgil Mahalanobis exchange on the NSS, it is very respectful. There are deep differences, yes, but it is always respectful, and they go back and forth on each details. Look at the level of detail. I can hardly think of any current economic policymaker who engages with economic statistics to that level of detail. So those were the factors, I think, which sort of helped in that stage. What was your second question? Sorry.
No, the second question was, what were the adaptations which they
so,
made?
Right. So for instance, how do you measure something like subsistence agriculture, right? When we started out in 1947, in the even 50s, 60s, the kind of farming that people used to do is very different from how people farm today, in the sense that a lot of production was just for self-consumption, right? So there was no monetary exchange. So how do you value that? There has to be some implicit pricing for that. Should that be included in the production boundary or not? First of all, that question. If it is, at what valuation? Right? And then you also have this question of employment. Should you use the standard definition that Western countries use of, you know, people going to regular work, or even if someone does subsistence labor or works half of the time, should they be included as a count of employment? And this will impact also how you define your labor force, also how those labor force projections get into your national account estimation. So this is a question that has implications on almost all the, from the labor market metrics to your macro metrics. So these questions were settled at a global level, actually by Indian statisticians, led by Mahalanobis, people like Manu Mukherjee, etc., that for developing countries, we need to tailor the national accounts classification in such a way that you allow for this informal sector output to come into the production boundary. These are the questions, and these are the research questions that they engaged with, so that not just India, but other developing countries could also develop national account standards that were somehow comparable with what the Western countries were producing, although those differences still remain. And people like Kuznets actually, in the early stages, were very skeptical of having developing countries follow the same SNA template. But then he sort of was persuaded by others to sort of accept it. And Kuznets actually played a critical role in developing India's national accounts itself. He was one of the advisors to the National Income Committee. And for a long time, he stayed in touch with Mahalanobis, Moni Mukherjee, and others. He wrote a review of the national accounts even after the National Income Committee had submitted its report on how it could be strengthened further. So the nature of the economy, the nature of subsistence activities, the nature of this part-time, transitory, ephemeral sort of employment activities, all of this made them sort of do definitional tweaks or sort of create new standards themselves. For instance, the first manual on national accounts standard, first SNA in 1953. The first was with the League of Nations, 1946, but the first UN SNA in 1953. One of the members of that was, there were five or six people headed by Richard Stone, and one of the members was Moni Mukherjee, who was the head of India's national income unit. And he was the only one from the developing world, only one from Asia. And in fact, the first Asian conference on national income organized by the International Association of Research in National Income and Wealth, that was conducted by V.K.R.V. Rao, sometime in the early 60s, and that volume was edited by Rao and a Japanese economist. I'm forgetting the name. So India and Japan were the only exceptions in a continent where other countries were struggling to sort of develop their own national accounts system. So India played a big role in sort of both ensuring that the global standards allow developing countries to join the League of Nations, which can produce national income estimates, as well as helping other countries. Also, the International Statistical Education Center, ISEC, I think it's called, was set up in ISI by UNESCO sometime in the mid-1950s. So a lot of statisticians from developing countries actually came to Kolkata to be trained in national accounts as well as in survey methods. And the final part of that is the design of household surveys was basically to address the needs primarily of developing countries. In fact, in the first session of the United Nations Statistical Commission, Mallambis raised this issue that developing countries do not have the kind of rich administrative data sets that Western countries have. So you are not going to be able to fill all the data holes unless you have some alternative methods. And what is that alternative method? The answer is survey. So the UNSC accepted his suggestion, not only accepted his suggestion, they formed a subcommittee on sampling, and Mallambis was made the chair. And the first few manuals on household surveys and large-scale sampling were basically prepared by Mallambis and his team for the world, not for just for India. So this was a sort of phase in which they felt they were not just building the nation, but they were also creating pathways for other developing countries to take part in this global project of having, you know, global public goods in the form of comparable data sets, and to allow other developing countries also to benefit from the Indian experience in planning and in developing economic statistics. So we didn't have to pretend to be Vishwa gurus at that stage. We were actually seen as one, as far as statistics was concerned.
You know, I speak of national accounts, and every quarter we get these GDP numbers. Where do they come from? Just give me a broad overview.
Yeah, so some of the so again, we can broadly think of two parts of the statistical system, right? One is the survey part, which is a national sample survey in case of India, where they select a representative part of the population, representative sample, to collect data on how much, what people are consuming, how much are they spending on different consumption items, and so on. And through that, they get, and then this is done typically every 5 years, but now it's been more than a decade since we have had any consumption survey. One survey just finished, but we don't have the data. So the data is outdated. But that's the data that was used in the last national accounts base year. So every 5 years or every 10 years, the national accounts get restructured, revised with a new base year. And that's when these surveys get plugged in to the
So,
national
as
accounts.
in, so, 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 as in, what surveys are done? As in, is it do we survey businesses, consumers, households?
So the two main household surveys, one is or three main household surveys. One is of consumers, consumer expenditure. One is of unemployment and employment, which has now been replaced by the PLFS, Periodic Labor Force Survey. And the third main survey, which is used in national accounts, is the debt and investment survey. So household investment numbers, fixed capital formation, some of it comes from that survey. And on the enterprise survey, the main benchmark survey is the informal sector survey, the survey of unincorporated enterprises. So all your data, or most of your data for the informal sector in that base year division, it comes from that survey. Now, as you have guessed, if these surveys are not being done annually, how do you project to the next years when those surveys are not taking place? So there, basically, we are using assumptions. It's as simple as that. And in the last revision, it was assumed that informal sector enterprises are, will grow at the same rate as formal sector enterprises. And this has been a key point of controversy because in the previous revision, the way in which growth in informal sector estimation was captured was different. So what they did was say the informal sector survey happened in 99, 2004, 5, and 2011, 12. So when they were doing the base year revision 2004, 5, they looked at the annual growth rate between 99 and 2004, 5, the average of those 5 years or the CAGR, whatever. And they used that to extrapolate to the future. And that had a problem in the sense that it was backdated, right? You were using past data to project into the future. To correct for that and to get current data, ideally they should have done an annual survey, right? So you get data for informal enterprises every year, and you plug that into the national accounts, and you sort of get the real picture from the ground. But they did not have the resources to do that, or they did not manage to convince the finance ministry to sanction those surveys. They didn't have the capacity to hire surveyors also. In 2011-12, there was a hiring crisis in NSS, which is only partially resolved today. So because of various factors, they didn't do that. And instead, they did Jugaad, which is they used the formal sector proxies. So they did it sector by sector. For each sector, there would be some tinkering. But broadly, for almost the entire agricultural, sorry, for the entire informal sector output, which is close to 46, 47% in 2011-12, they just used the extrapolation based on formal sector proxies, except for agriculture. Because agricultural data comes from districts and states through the agriculture ministry, and that is collected every season. So for the Rabi season, Kharif season, every season they do estimate of how much is being, what is the acreage, how much land is being cultivated, what are the crops. At least for major crops, rice and wheat, pulses, etc., there is a regular data stream. For some of the horticulture products, poultry, etc., data there is almost equally bad. But at least for roughly, say, 17-18% of your GDP, which is agriculture, you have some sense of what's happening annually.
It
Quarterly,
seems to
even,
me,
sorry.
sorry, go on.
Quarterly, even there, even in agriculture, there's a huge issue, but at least annually you have some sense. So the informal sector whole remains. And although they have started annual surveys of unincorporated enterprises, there have been already three rounds. They have not released the data. And I'm told there are some problems with it, but I don't know whether the problems are in with the data or the problems are in what the data reveals. So we'll get to know that when the data comes out.
Yeah, and it seems as if the reason why agricultural data is there is because there's great political demand for it, because the fact is that they need to implement subsidy programs and, for MSP purchases and so on. And like the bigger meta question I'd like to ask you is that, politically, nobody really cares about the details of GDP process. You get a nice 7.5% number, the number goes up, people are happy, number goes down, people are sad. And what is the political economy of these things? I can see one force pushing for these numbers to be over-optimistic, which that politicians like to show good numbers, but I see no countervailing force pushing for them to be more realistic, except for the conscience of the specific economists and statisticians dealing with these.
Yes, that's a real challenge. I mean, we are lucky that there have been no outright efforts to sort of manipulate GDP numbers. One reason also is perhaps because it is quite hard to do, given the interlinkages between different sectors. If you try and manipulate one particular sector for one particular year, it will have lasting effects in the coming years also. So you can't just change one cell in an Excel sheet and be done with it. It will have repercussions all around. And at least from the production side and the expenditure side, there has to be some match. I mean, there is a discrepancy factor, but it's not huge. So of course, There is no outright manipulation, but there is a broad political economy consensus that the GDP numbers should not look too bad. I mean, that is something that is at the back of the minds of even the national accountants. So when the base year revision happens, that's when there's a chance that you get a picture which may be slightly discomfiting to policymakers or to politicians, and then you also at that time run parallel tracks of inquiry onto various methods that can be used to improve or to change certain estimation procedure. At that stage, there is a lot of subjectivity involved in which method you finally adopt. And of course, they do internal committees, etc., and they invite external people. But as we saw in the 2014-15 division, there was dissidence around this. And one of the reasons was this, that the manufacturing sector's contribution, as shown by Mossby's method, was higher than what could have been shown by the alternative methods. And this remains a point of bone of contention till date. And it is something that now even people from the PMAC have sort of argued is problematic. I mean, Vivek Debray and Amay Sapre wrote an article in Mint some time back saying that this manufacturing sector estimation is problematic. So you are absolutely right. There is no strong ring-fenced mechanism to insulate these statistical exercises from short-termist political manipulations and machinations. There are weak sort of mechanisms that produce some semblance of normalcy. One of this is the sort of convention that you always have an advisory committee to go over this, you have independent consultants, independent reviewers coming in. The second is that India has to report its national accounts and its estimation techniques to global institutions such as the United Nations Statistical Commission and the IMF. And IMF actually sends a team after every revision to sort of review how the revision has been done. And in fact, in the last revision, the IMF review team flagged the issue of deflators. They didn't put it out in the public at that stage, but later it came up. So that is the second level of check. And the third level of check is this centralized sort of statistical cadre. So at least at the center, there is a cadre of Indian Statistical Service officials who are permanent appointees and who have a rich legacy from the Malinowski years and who are generally proud statisticians and who try to ensure that the work did. And most of them are very honest officers and they try to ensure some kind of impartiality in their work. Now, this ISS cadre has also come under criticism for not being in tune with the times, not being tech friendly, and not being sort of responsive to the needs of data users, and all that is true. But I would hesitate to sort of do it away in one shot, and because it also on the flip side, it also provides a layer of protection to statistical work. Because it allows a certain level of professionalism to come into play in producing national. If you look at many other poorer developing countries in Africa, and their books written on this, they don't have such a system. They don't have such a cadre, and there's been havoc. We don't actually know what's going on in the national accounts of these countries, and multilateral institutions just take the numbers as they're given and do some amount of statistical manipulation at their end and give us a sort of process numbers without really bothering to check what the ground realities are. So your question is really important, and which is why in my paper, if you've seen, I've argued for an independent and empowered statistical commission because of this dual nature of statistics, that in one way it is an input into policy making. At the other end, it is also in a modern democratic country, it is also a mirror through which citizens evaluate governance, through which citizens evaluate how the world is moving and how India is moving, how their country, how their state, how their district is faring vis-a-vis others. So there is a conflict, inherent conflict in official statistics in the sense that it is being used for policy making. At the same time, it is being used to monitor policy.
The Chinese Premier Li Keqiang once told in a leaked conversation to the American ambassador, he leaked that he himself didn't believe his country's GDP numbers, and he used the index of railway growth and electricity production and factory output and so on. And like in India, there's a similar, informal or consensus in the index exists too. We have a lot of high frequency indicators in car production and so on. Does something of that sort, is it there?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I mean, India is, despite the decline in India's statistical standards, we are nowhere like
Yeah,
China.
we're of course, of course.
But at the same time, you do see economists both in the private sector and in the government sector using a range of high-frequency indicators, as they should. I mean, regardless of whether GDP is reliable or not, people do want high frequency. I mean, at best, you will get quarterly GDP numbers, right? There's no country that produces at a higher frequency than quarterly. Whereas you get frequency, I mean, you get weekly power consumption, you get monthly car sales, you get monthly PMI, you get monthly vehicle registration numbers. So a lot of other data are available at a much higher.
I think the UK ONS gives monthly GDP, but even they have a big star and disclaimer saying don't believe this.
And the US has a GDP now. The Atlanta Fed, I think, has a GDP now program where they do now casting. And to some extent, RBI also does some amount of now casting, although I don't think they don't release those figures, but they're used for monetary policy making. So yes, high frequency indicators are used, and a lot of the criticisms about GDP numbers in recent years has come about because now you have much a greater range of high frequency indicators coming from different ministries because of the digitization of data sets, and because you have a lot of public data sets available for different parts of the economy, analysts from the financial markets otherwise also are able to question MOSPI as to why the GDP is not mirroring what some other data sets are showing. Now, some of that criticism may be misplaced because GDP is the sum of everything. So it is not going to move with each particular indicator. But at the same time, some of it may be justified. I mean, and the questions, especially on the constant prices GDP, which is GDP adjusted for inflation, the real GDP growth, I think are valid. So one of the key problems in the GDP estimation I already mentioned was the informal sector. The other key problem is how do you measure the real output, which is output adjusted for inflation. And to do that, you need really good detailed price indices, which we lack. So we have consumer price indices, which is based on old data, 2011-12, the last consumer expenditure survey that I talked about, which is outdated. You have a wholesale price index, which is not only outdated, but also lacks any data on services. So India is one of the few G20 economies which does not have a producer price index. And we don't have services price indices. There has been some experimental work on building services price indices, but it has not fructified. And you use some proxies based on the subcomponents of WPI, etc., which are wrong, and which national accountants also know are wrong, but they end up using it. And which is why the real GDP growth rates are seen as far more doubtful compared to the nominal GDP numbers. Although I'm not saying that the nominal GDP numbers are flawless, but still, the trend in nominal GDP is likely to be more accurate compared to the real GDP numbers in the Indian case. And one last point concerning high frequency indicators is that see the in high frequency indicators, if you look at countries like UK and US, they have at almost every decade there is a statistical review of some kinds. They change certain things, they introduce new surveys, they introduce new techniques, they bring in a lot of administrative data and evaluate them statistically, bring new statistical products. India has lacked that kind of experimentation, that kind of innovation for several decades. And you know, this was one of the key sort of problems, especially after the 1990s, because once you liberalize the economy, a lot of your data flows that came because of the license permit Raj stopped flowing in. Because earlier, every production unit, because it wanted to expand, because it wanted to export, or because it wanted to import, had to send in a lot of data to the ministries, the Ministry of Industry, Ministry of Commerce, etc. So MOSPI or CSO could gather a lot of information just from the government departments themselves. And that information flow stopped after liberalized. So you needed a parallel market-friendly system, and which would also meet the needs of the market economy. Because now the needs of data are not just with the official data users in the Planning Commission and the Finance Ministry, but you had a stock market that was getting in new investments from foreigners. You had new investment banks coming into India, new financial analysts tracking the economy, and you needed to service them. And they began demanding more high frequency data. And that's how the quarterly GDP started. So quarterly GDP started in the US sometime in the 50s. In India, it started only in 1996. And also because the IMF demanded, India signed the IMF SDDS standards, and that required India to furnish quarterly GDP numbers. But to estimate quarterly GDP, the kind of investments needed in new surveys, new high frequency indicators, was not put in. So they used the old data and did some statistical sort of assumptions, estimations, and fitted it that into the quarterly GDP numbers. And even today, national accountants, if you go and meet them off the record, they will tell you that the quarterly GDP series is far less trustworthy than the annual numbers, although that is the number that is being used by everybody, right from the private sector to the government sector. Because by the time the annual numbers come in, the final estimates, it's like 2.5 years down the line, by which time it is only of academic relevance.
I get the sense that while our recent problems are real, the real problem is that structurally there is no place for an independent statistical commission, and
Yes.
even at the local level data. In fact, I was doing a project some time ago with some professors, and we wanted district level GDP, and we had to use some weird method of interpolating some night lights, and even that had problems. And I want to talk to you more about these proposals for reform, because we've had the Rangarajan committee, we had some before liberalization also. And basically, what do they ask for, and how can governments do better on this?
Yeah, so some of the reform proposals are motivated by how things were in the early years. I don't want to call it the glorious years or anything, but where statisticians were an important part of policymaking and where they had an impactful role. And one of the key sort of findings of various committees, and which I also sort of agree with, is that most of the people in the statistical system at that time, at least in senior leadership positions, were people who had a good understanding of both statistics and economics, and who had a good understanding of policy making. They knew not just how well they not just knew well how the data was being collected, but they also knew how the data was being used and being used for policy making. So that, I think, is a big difference between then and now. Now the statistician is just a data provider. He's not an analyst. And globally, if you see most statistical offices have invested over the past few decades in forecasting units, in trying to integrate their statistical work with those of geographers and GIS specialists, etc., and to service a broader range of data users, and develop more frequent sort of feedback loops so that they're able to service the needs of different data users. So that the feedback loop actually existed in India in the early years, but has slowly disappeared over time. And now you have a system where often the data producer does not have a clear view of the requirements of a large part of your data ecosystem. So that is one. The second part is that at the highest level of policy making, you had the planning commission, which was deeply invested in a sound statistical system. In a market economy, you can't have a planning commission determining the economic plan for the entire economy. But you can and should have local units ranging from state governments to district administration stepping up and becoming more involved both in the data collection process as well as in providing constructive feedback to improve the data statistical system. And there also, there has been historical factors as well why states did not invest enough in the state statistical system. It is only now that states are waking up to the importance of the statistical system, to the importance of data. And a few states have set up some review committees, statistical commissions to sort of redo their statistics. But these are just baby steps. I mean, the kind of decline in state statistical systems that has happened over the past few decades will take several years to sort of undo. And this cannot be solved by, hiring some consultants on a part-time basis or engaging consultancies and doing some quick surveys. This calls for building up state capacity at a district and at a state level and with multiple stakeholders involved in it. So I don't see, any sort of quick fix for this local data part. But the center can show the path, at least in terms of providing enabling legislation, in terms of providing robust statistical audit system, so that data users are assured that the data quality checks have been reviewed by external reviewers, and there is a pathway towards progress. Like an audit it's not like a financial audit. A statistical audit is also meant to sort of improve the statistical products over a period of time. So an audit report will tell you what are the next steps that are required to improve a particular statistical product. So the only statistical product in India which had an audit was the IIP in 2011. And that was the last time NSE commissioned any audit. And even those audit committee recommendations were not implemented. And there were a number of review committees. Even those committees were, most of the recommendations were sort of ignored. So unless you have an empowered body at the central level and at the state level that continually pushes the statistical system to act on these recommendations, to innovate, and to set standards across ministries so that the incoming data itself is of a certain quality. We will have these kind of patchwork solutions and we'll have periodic statistical controversies.
And in fact, the private sector has in some way met that demand for statistical numbers with the CMIE. And what do you think of those numbers? Because I've been advised many times off the record not to use them in analysis because they're not as robust as the labor force participation survey. But my other answer is this gives me data every week and that gives me data every 3 months if and when it comes. So most people are willing to take that trade-off and use private sector data.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, CMI, especially during the pandemic, proved to be of great help because the PLFS numbers came much later. And it gave a sense of the mass migration from urban to rural areas, the huge shift in rural labor force, the dip in urban labor force, etc. And so directionally, especially when there are big shifts, I think CMI, despite its limitations, is able to capture. But when there are not that big shifts, for that, the survey instrument needs to be really precise and really representative of the population. That I think CMI has failed to do so far. And this is something that Mahesh Vyas has also accepted in a recent talk in Delhi a few months back. And some of the criticisms of John Rez and others he accepts are true. And there are problems in the sampling frame. And part of it may be because of cost. It's very hard to do rural, especially rural, cover the rural areas well. And even if the government of India spends 0.2% of its budget on the statistical system, it's still a large amount. For a private sector to spend that much and to recoup it through user fees and so on, it's a tall ask. And from what I understand, most of CMI's users are academics. So the private sector actually doesn't pay. There are very few private, I mean, as a proportion, there are very few private players in India who are willing to pay for CMI's consumer payroll. They are willing to pay for other data sets which are less pricey. So CMI also does collates data from, say, listed firms, as CMI Prowess database. There's a CMI CapEx database, which are less expensive, and obviously because they don't involve like unit level data collection, ground level data collection. And they are used much more widely in the private sector compared to the consumer pyramids. The consumer pyramids has been actively used by the academic sector, and the aggregate numbers of the consumer pyramids, which are available in other CMI packages such as CMI Economic Outlook, those numbers are cited frequently by economists because there is no other. I mean, it's like I know there are problems in it, but there is no other high frequency data, so let me use it. So there is just a case of there being no choice. And globally also, I mean, yes, some private sector data operators in some parts of the world do play a meaningful role in servicing the needs of data users, but largely for economic data sets, it's the state that has to step in. I mean, no other agent has that kind of convening capacity to get all the to give you a full 360-degree view of what's happening in the economy. And the state also has the power of force. Like in most census acts, for instance, or many survey acts also, not survey acts, at least in the census acts, the state can actually force you to give answers. Although that provision is, that penal provisions are rarely used, but I mean, it's still, it counts for something. And in the Indian context, just imagine going to Manipur, 3 months down the line to do a survey. I mean, even for state agencies, it's difficult. For a private person to go there would be really difficult. Or to go to a Naxal-affected territory and do a survey. So because of those considerations also, the sampling frame has to be truncated in a private survey. But having said that, there could be other private associations and private groups that could provide meaningful data. So for SIAM, which is the Automobile Association, for instance, provides monthly data on auto sales. And at one point, at least CSO also tapped into it. I don't know whether they still do it. Some parts of SIAM data. So similarly, other industries, so for instance, the restaurant industry could produce a high frequency data on what's happening, gross value added in the restaurant sector, for which we don't have really good data coming in from the official statistical agencies. The trade sector, so for instance, if all the shopkeepers associations of different parts of the country get together and they collate the data and give, that would be a very valuable indicator. So there is scope for, and this happens much more in a much more organized way in countries like the UK, in some parts of Europe, etc. So there is a case for trade associations to come in and step in and fulfill some of the and fill in some of the gaps that exist today. There is a role of private surveyors also in some contexts, but still, despite all this, you will still need the state to up its game.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, we talked about CMI, the people not paying. It sounds like a classic public goods problem. One person creates the data and everyone can see it for free. And we're reaching the end of our time here. But what makes you optimistic about India's national accounts system? Is it, to sort of end this on an optimistic note, what do you look forward to in the next 3 4 years?
See, so one of the good things that has happened is there the entire survey system, although it has been attacked, there have also been attempts at reforms. So you have many new annual surveys. You have an annual survey of unincorporated enterprises. You have a new survey of consumption expenditure, which hopefully will be done much more frequently, if not annually, at least every 3 years. And the second round is already underway. You have a new annual survey of services. On that, I have really very limited information, but from what I know, at least two rounds have been completed. So you have a host of new surveys which are trying to fill in gaps. These are precisely the gaps that sort of made national content estimation challenging over the past few years. And hopefully, when the next national accounts revision happens, some of the earlier problems will get solved. The other thing is the MCA 21 database, which was an addition, which was an innovation done last time, but which created complications of its own, and especially at the state level. So there, I'm not sure how that problem is going to be solved, but one of the recommendations of one of the committees is to map MCA data with ASI and try and figure out if there's a way to have bottoms-up estimates. That's still a recommendation, and it would be hard to implement. If that happens, that will be a great step forward in establishing the credibility of these numbers and also giving us a way to sort of cross-check across databases and allow the databases to talk to each other. On the prices front, also, there has been some activity in terms of building a producer price index, but the timeline I'm not sure of. So there I am less optimistic. And there I think it's just a question of will. I mean, it's not that difficult a thing to build a robust producer price index. I mean, it's a low-hanging fruit. And I think if enough people demand it, speak up, enough influential economists lobby for it, I think the government will also be forced to pay heed to this demand.
All right, thank you very much. I have many, many questions, but I'll save it for the time your book comes out. So, if our viewers want to catch you online, how can they find you?
So they can write to me at pramit_b@protonmail.com. I'm also at on Twitter and LinkedIn, and they can find me there, and they can message me, and they can write to me there.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Pradyumna. Thank you for having me on your podcast.